from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. This is Hal Kempfer, and I'm going to talk about the new national security strategy that just came out. To say it has earth-shattering, but global implications would be to put it kind of lightly. It is really shaking up a lot of things. It's talking about basically fundamental changes in some of the alliance structure that the U.S. has around the world. It's changed the language by which we describe what our big near-peer competitor, China, is. It has language in there that's kind of unusual about Russia, and it's definitely got the Europeans talking about a lot. So I'm going to talk about some things. I'm going to try and cover good or bad. I'll try to explain why some of these things are in there, but also explain some of the reaction to what's going on. And, well, anyway, let me get going. The Trump administration released its kind of long-awaited national security strategy this last week. I'm going to call it the NSS going forward, if I could, or at least as often as I can. It's a periodically released document. You know, administrations always have a strategy. They don't have to do it every single year, but generally speaking, they try to keep it current, fresh, and certainly in years past, sometimes our strategy seemed to get a little stale over time. It's this 2025 document has been the subject of a little bit of confusion and curiosity in Washington and elsewhere. Now, it reportedly was actually finished last summer, but it's been held up for months with various officials in the government basically pushing for amendments or slight changes. And then Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, if you recall, in heated discussions on tariffs and trade with China, and he didn't want to jeopardize those ongoing trade talks. So this thing has been delayed a bit. Definitely didn't come out in the first 100 days. Let's just put it that way. Now, the strategy describes Trump's vision as what they refer to as flexible realism, right? I think Pete Hegseth just said something about, I don't know, idealistic utopianism or something was the way he's trying to describe it before. But they call flexible realism an argument that the U.S. should revive. Some would say the 19th century Monroe Doctrine. I think that's a good way to describe the Monroe Doctrine, although it definitely was 19th into well into the 20th century, which basically was a new U.S., new United States was basically telling the European powers, hey, the Western Hemisphere is the United States zone of influence. And this is in the era of colonialism all over the world. And as you know, in Central South America, Mexico, elsewhere, the 19th century was a very tumultuous time. The end of Spanish colonialism was upon the world, or the decline of Spanish colonialism, which kind of declined precipitously at the very end of the 19th century, some would say the very beginning of the 20th century, wherein the U.S. actively got involved with war in Cuba and in the Philippines, called the Spanish-American War. Anyway, the strategy also has warned that Europe faces what and this the language is pretty stark, they call civilizational erasure, and it says that Europe must change course. Now, obviously, European leaders, several European officials, and current and former, have pushed back against this. They, you know, the assertion that Europe faces the prospect of civilizational erasure, and saying that it is more than plausible that within a few decades, at the latest, certain NATO members will become majority non-European. That obviously is pretty harsh language in itself. But then it calls for the U.S. to take steps to help the continent correct its current trajectory. And that implies that the U.S. is going to get involved in politics in Europe. And that's always been kind of a forbidden role. Nations are not supposed to interfere in the politics, the elections of other nations. And we have seen over the last year that we've had more than one official go over to Europe and give speeches, or I should say individuals, either officials or people associated with the government working with the Trump administration have gone over and given some strong, basically pretty strong partisan political speeches that show that there is a certain leaning of one political party versus another. Obviously, this resulted in harsh criticism from Europe. The former Swedish Prime Minister Carl Bildt posted on X saying that it places the U.S. on the extreme right in Europe. He said it's language that one otherwise only finds coming out of the bizarre minds of the Kremlin. So that's pretty strong language from a former Swedish prime minister. Former French ambassador to the United States, Gerard Araud, said the stunning section devoted to Europe reads like a far-right pamphlet. And he says it largely confirms perceptions that Trump is a, quote, enemy of Europe, unquote. All right. Again, pretty strong language. Now, current official, the German foreign minister, Johann Badefuhl, actually was a little bit softer in his criticism. He said, our most important ally, he said the U.S. was and would remain our most important ally in the NATO alliance, but said his country did not need outside advice. All right, so not taking a hard swipe at the Trump administration, but basically asserting a German independence, if you will, saying, look, we don't need the U.S. telling us how to run our own politics in our country. U.S. Democratic lawmakers have raised alarm about this document as well. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut wrote on X, foreshadows setbacks, forsaking allies, throwing Ukraine under the bus, and abandoning key strategic goals and basic values. All right, pretty strong language. Again, yes, partisan, but Blumenthal's been around for a while. Daniel Field, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, previously served as the National Security Council's senior director for Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Ambassador of Poland, Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, said the strategy had, quote, internal incoherence. All right. So in other words, this has certainly evoked a response on both sides of the Atlantic amongst both current and foreign senior officials. Some of the language is very strong. Of course, any country, to include the United States, takes umbrage when other countries try to tell us how to do our own business. Europe, which is largely under the European Union, as the word kind of implies, a union, kind of been working together for a long time. They definitely take this sort of, overarching U.S., we're going to tell you how to run your politics in your country, sort of language with a distinct disdain, shall we say. Now, among the things it claims in the document is that Europe is facing, well, basically attacks migration policies, and it also attacks what they call censorship of free speech, suppression of political opposition, falling birth rates, loss of national identity, self-confidence, and argues the weakening of the continent, putting on a path to becoming unrecognizable in 20 years. This is really, it was some language that definitely got some revokes in. And also it talked about the U.S., our role, maybe cultivating resistance to Europe's current trajectory within European nations. And it notes positively the growing influence of patriotic European parties. This tends to be a nod to the far-right parties like the AfD in Germany. These parties tend to be anti-immigration, and they have previously earned public backing from members of the administration, Trump administration before. It also seems, and I don't know, the parallel was that it's basically adopting the Great Replacement Theory, which has been a white supremacist far-right mantra in the U.S. You know, if you remember the stuff that was going on at the University of Virginia way back when, with people running around with KKK crosses and everything else, they were talking about the Great Replacement Theory. Well, in this one, it's kind of a Euro version of that, which it talks about countries will be non-European. And there is a certain amount of truth there that there's been a lot of migration to Europe from around the world. You got to remember Britain and France were huge colonial nations. And at the end of their colonial empires, a lot of the citizens of those nations migrated to France and Great Britain to have a better life. And to live a better lifestyle and, better than where they were in their home countries. And that has changed certainly the ethnic breakdown within each of those countries. It's also changed the religious breakdown of those countries. And it's also had a shift on the culture within those countries. And I think that's what this document was addressing, although in pretty harsh terms, basically saying, you're no longer going to be European nations because of all that migration, builds on what had become something of an adversarial relationship, despite moments where it looked like we were all in the same sheet of music, but a generally adversarial situation or relationship with the Trump administration and a lot of European countries. And it echoes what Vice President J.D. Vance had said at the Munich Security Conference earlier in the year, where he very much criticized European nations on their policies, on free speech, argued the gravest danger to these countries was not Russia or China, but their own governments. And obviously that landed in Europe like a thud. Look, the United States, it says the United States, and this is part of this thing is, we've been talking about the pivot to the Pacific for quite some time. The problem with the pivot to the Pacific, even though we recognize the threat of China, we recognize the importance of the Pacific in the global economy, in many ways eclipsing what had previously been the importance of Europe in the global economy. And it's not just China, it's all the other countries around Asia that the U.S. has a strong trade relationship with, and vital supply chain issues that go through Asia. We've been trying to pivot to the Pacific, and every time we try to do that from a military national security standpoint, we tend to get drugged back into either the Middle East or Europe. And that seemed, and this is, I think, a response to that. Whereas this last year, we got very much, or last couple, 3 years, we got very much pulled back into the Middle East with the wars, the 12-day war with Iran, you know, the Gaza thing, Yemen blocking one of the most critical sea lanes in the world because of the Houthi threat or the Houthi attacks on shipping. And so we got pulled very much into the Middle East on that. And then, of course, with the war in Ukraine, very much pulled back into working in Europe and focused on what has truly been the biggest war in Europe since World War II. So this is something of a reaction to that, saying, look, we got to shift. It also addresses another thing, the corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. It says it's common sense restoration of American power priorities consistent with American security interests. This one, I don't disagree that the U.S. has been ignoring what's going on in Central and South America to our own peril. I did some consulting in the renewable energy industry, particularly looking at lithium and sourcing of lithium. And I was rather surprised, prior to the current Trump administration, and this surprise carries into the first Trump administration, but carries on before that, is just kind of how indifferent we were to some of these things that we consider critical to our energy future, but also generally that we just weren't very engaged in Central South America at all, or Latin America. We weren't that engaged in the Caribbean, and yet here it is right on our borders. This is the thing that's closest to us. So this does shift that interest back there. Now, you may remember earlier in the year, right when the Trump administration came in, they were talking about, you know, the U.S. may have to retake the Panama Canal and annex Greenland and annex Canada. And certainly that got a lot of discussion going, but it was this focus on the Western Hemisphere, and this document definitely puts in there. Now, more recently, we got the possibility of U.S. strikes in Venezuela. We've had U.S. strikes on drug boats in the Caribbean and the East Pacific, going after drug cartels, redesignating the drug cartels as terrorist groups, which changes their legal status. And we got about 15,000 personnel on ships sitting out in the Caribbean outside of Venezuela. Not an invasion force, but a very potent strike force. So we definitely have put more real attention on Europe as well. Now, Emmanuel Macron of France has basically been talking about this. There's a leaked phone call that he had where he was talking to other European leaders and claiming that President Trump was going to betray Ukraine during peace negotiations, and basically telling the European allies that the Trump administration would attempt to force Ukraine to give up territory without any clarity on any security guarantees. And Der Spiegel, the German publication, actually reported a lot of this. And it says he basically was talking to Merz over in Germany. He was talking to Rutte and NATO, von der Leyen and the European Union, and making this very clear. And the transcript of this was leaked out. This was tied to the anticipation, or the, I should say, release of the 28-point plan, which in fact did have things in there that was talking about Ukraine giving up territory. And frankly, and I've said this in multiple forums, that the 28-point plan looked very close to previously Kremlin talking points on how they saw a possible peace thing. But with that, once that went out there, Putin, as he tends to do, shifts further out, and he went to maximalist goals. So right now, I don't know where that's going. It seems to be a lot of discussion, people saying making real concrete progress. I'm not holding my breath. It's also a significant shift in this document on how we explain China. Under the Biden administration, China was explicitly named as the U.S.'s primary foreign policy challenge. That administration was very vocal about its support for Taiwan, which is since we recognize the PRC as you know, the People's Republic of China, and normalized relations with them, we stopped recognizing Taiwan and the Republic of China, all right, which goes back to, you know, basically before China became communist, mainland China, I should say, became communist. We shifted and said that. And so we basically recognize one China, although we fiercely recognize that Taiwan is a self-governing entity. We don't recognize this as an independent country per se. There is what we call strategic ambiguity in our language, all right? That's something that we've always tried to maintain in past strategies. You remember, it was a big deal when Biden came out and said that we would commit military forces to defend Taiwan, all right? This one starts to shift a little bit. The new national security strategy maintains the language of strategic competition with the PRC, People's Republic of China, when discussing Taiwan's status, and calls for working more closely with partners and allies in the Pacific to deter any attempts to seize Taiwan. But it also plays down the ideological differences between the U.S. and China, and instead seems to put the focus on economics and trade front and center in this relationship. Okay, so a lot of big changes in this document, recognizing that what this is doing, if I could take a step back, the U.S., look, Europe has been underinvesting in its own defense for a very, very long time. First administration of Trump, he pointed this out right, you know, very directly, and said, look, you got to spend more of your gross domestic product on this. And right now there's a commitment in Europe to get it up to about 5%. There were countries in Europe that were below 1% of defense investment, of GDP equivalent of investment in defense, I should say, of their own countries. Countries have been dropping conscription. They've been dropping the size of their military. Britain's military looks anemic compared to what it was, and anemic compared to what it's supposed to be able to do. And they're not the only country like that. So you're seeing Europe kind of step up. And I kind of say, look, it was going to take a lot to get these European countries to come together. And maybe the strategy has been that the U.S. is kind of pulling the rug out from under them and saying, okay, there's Russia, good luck. And it probably, maybe it was a tough love approach is what they're doing. I don't know. I will say that's what it's kind of turned out to be. But then again, I kind of look, I go, what would it, you know, of the options of getting the European countries to really step up their own defense, what would it take? And I'm sure if I was to have this discussion, you know, 10 years ago, that some would say it would probably take about something of this magnitude to get the Europeans knocked out of their lethargy and to seriously invest in defense. So that's kind of interesting. The other thing too, Taiwan has been grossly underinvesting in its own defense, and they had been going downhill for a very long time. That's turning around, but the reality of defending Europe, the reality of Taiwan deterring a Chinese invasion, is that they have to have significant capabilities there on the ground that are organic to the countries involved. Poland has to be able to really put up a credible defense of Poland. The Baltic states have to be able to put credible defense of the Baltic states, not just sit there with a small military and say, don't worry, the U.S. will come and defend us, which is kind of what was going on for a very long time, putting tremendous stress and cost on the U.S. for commitments of military resources that they really need to commit themselves. And of course, one of the things too is if there is a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, it is probably more likely than not that there will be something else in the world, maybe over in Europe, that will also be pulling on our resources. I would not be surprised, a friendship that knows no bounds between China and Russia, as they like to call themselves, that Russia might do something in the Baltics or something around Poland or whatever that would cause a U.S. response under NATO Article 5. And then you would see something happen in the South China Sea. Then something would happen with Taiwan or something that confronts Japan or something like that. So some of this may be just some, stark realism in that that's kind of how the world works. And these countries need to really invest, and they need to invest very quickly in their own defense. And maybe the strategy addresses that. So yeah, pretty confrontational language, telling countries how to run their own, or at least kind of implying that we're telling countries how to run their own internal politics. Definitely going to get a lot of pushback. But there is some real politic in this, which goes to basic defense matters, which goes to basic national defense matters. It gives the U.S. an opportunity to maybe pull back from our more extenuated positioning around the world and give us a little bit of flexibility in terms of where we allocate resources in a future conflict. With all this, obviously, it's having some shockwaves throughout Congress, and there does appear to be an emerging coalition of conservative Republicans, not necessarily strong MAGA Republicans, not anti-MAGA per se, but not strong MAGA Republicans, but some Republicans who are very concerned about the language about Russia, very much pro-support of Ukraine, have strong ideological differences and feel that they probably feel that should be emphasized with the People's Republic of China. And they're looking at this, and we're starting to see a shift. And there might be some sort of new national security coalition forming in Congress that could be a lot more bipartisan than what we've seen so far. We got a fast approaching midterm election, and I'm kind of waiting to see how this is going to play out, because there's a very good possibility that this could shift power in Congress. And I will also say that necessity does tend to spawn change very quickly. Hey, thanks for listening to Strat. Also, please go to stratpodcast.com if that's not where you saw this. You can go to my YouTube channel at Hal Kempfert TV. You can go to GRIPSA, Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, our website, www.gripsa.com. And I hope you listen to the next one. And I hope this maybe was a little thought-provoking as we go into the holidays.